It's like, I don't care about nothing, man. Roll another.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and Simon Schuster. A little later, Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight is going to break down his maps that he drew of a potential 2021 congressional map that just looking at it right now, it has some very compact boundaries, only breaks 10 county boundaries, 12 municipal boundaries. Looks pretty realistic to me. We're going to go ahead and talk to him later about the specifics on that. Also, Saul Anousis, who is with Coast to Coast Strategies, talking about his drive to continue with the National Popular Vote Compact. May not be all that popular on the onset with Republicans, but why should Republicans get involved? He'll explain that a little later. But first, guys, the big story today, and we're recording on March 13, is the Enbridge pipeline. Enbridge is in town to defend their pipeline again. New information coming out about the material, the protective coating around their pipe has come out and that it's corroding. And it seems to be, Jack, that this is a drip, drip, drip scenario for Enbridge where they are slowly losing the public relations battle. And why is that a bad thing?
First of all, they're hurt by the fact that they can't say it's never happened before with their other breaks that they've had over the years. You take that out of their toolbox, you know, to say, well, we've been doing this for so many decades and there's never been a problem with it. They can't say that, so they've got that problem. The next problem you have is, how are they fighting this? Are they doing any PR with the average person? Are they going after any kind of a strategy that involves more than whatever it is they're doing? I assume they're talking to the legislature, but are they even attempting to win a popular contest over their environmental foes?
Because it can happen, right? I mean, look at the Keystone Pipeline. The Republicans were able to turn that into some sort of a winning message. You had Sarah Palin out there yelling, drill, baby, drill. You can do it, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of effort here.
If there has been, boy, I haven't seen it. People have to remember, the slant drilling thing is the classic example back in the early 2000s. Where you had such a push on the part of those who were against it that I actually have always guessed that if you had taken polling in the middle of it, I really wonder how many Michigan voters would have thought slant drilling was worse than regular drilling. When in fact, of course, slant drilling was done for environmental purposes because it was to try to avoid regular drilling, and yet the PR was so strong and so almost omnipresent at the time that I really think that a lot of people actually thought there was something particularly bad about slant drilling.
When we're looking at this, Simon, you look at what Attorney General Bill Schuette is doing. He has not been a big fan of the Enbridge pipeline. He has not been a defender of them. And going into the 2018 gubernatorial election, this is a bad sign. Jack mentioned slant drilling. In 2002, Dick Posthumus had to break from John Engler on this issue and come out against slant drilling because he didn't want to get pounded by it. Same thing could happen in 2018 if Enbridge doesn't turn around this public relations problem they have.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the issue, is that for a long time, this debate was kind of framed around the issue of, for the people, there was an analysis done by the University of Michigan that showed where oil would land if there was a break along Line 5. But then for a long time, the debate was framed around the issue of what if, you know, what if this happened? What if? But basically Enbridge had the room, you know, ground to defend itself on, because they could say, listen, this is highly unlikely. We've done analyses of the pipeline. But now that a study has come out that's not been sponsored by Enbridge, is wholly independent, and is saying that, listen, there are serious issues here, then they are once again on the defense from a factual standpoint.
They've never been on the offense, Jack, and it seems to me that there is some offensive ground they can go as far as the economic impact, oil prices, something, and how this could impact the regular citizens, not a theoretical discussion about what would happen if the pipe bursts and we have oil-covered salmon being washed up on the shore.
And in reality, pipelines, if you're not going to move it by a pipe, you're going to move it some other way, and some of those other ways arguably maybe actually more dangerous for some kind of pollution down the line in terms of trucking it and other ways that they may have to do it instead. And yet, I don't think there's been any effort on their part that I've seen to make any of those arguments. My sense is they're a company that has decided to win it strategically with the lobbyists and with the legislature rather than trying to win it with the public, at least at this stage. And you do have people who sit back and say, well, we're 2 years out from the next election, so you don't do it yet, et cetera, et cetera. And as far as Schuette goes, being attorney general, I would say he probably has to tread very carefully on this for the next year and a half.
If that wasn't enough, you have a new head of the EPA who has largely enraged environmentalists with some of his comments on the public record. And this is something where people are being, you know, mobilized and are really infuriated on a lot of environmental issues. And so this only compounds some of the sentiments that are, you know, I guess, rippling through environmental circles in this state.
It's hard to defend big oil. It can be done, but big oil has to fight back and they got to try. And right now we're not seeing it from the public aspect, as you said, Jack. Well, Simon, last week you were able to put together a long research that you had done into the state of medical marijuana in the state of Michigan. And the conclusion I drew from your very well done piece is that there are folks who feel like they still have to go undercover and go through kind of back channels to get their medical marijuana card because they don't think they're going to get it from their regular doctor. And those back channels may not be getting them a medical marijuana card that they can expect can hold through some kind of legal scrutiny.
Yeah, I mean, the medical marijuana industry in Michigan has long been a point of fascination for me, Kyle, and that's because it is a burgeoning industry that is, you know, quite profitable for the people who are involved in it, but there's a host of federal issues in terms of illegality that makes them, you know, it almost constrains the industry, and at the same time makes traditional healthcare providers very hesitant in terms of, you know, wanting to wade into this. And as a result, there's a lot of legal ambiguities. We enacted the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act in 2008, and we gave it basically a skeleton of a regulatory framework. And since then, there have been attempts to, you know, bolster that and make it, you know, put some muscles on the skeleton. But for the most part, it has existed as, you know, a frame rather than necessarily a house.
So to be clear, you went through the process and actually got a medical marijuana card. For our listeners' benefit and for authorities and everybody else, Simon does have a medical condition with which that he can legally get a medical marijuana card. But having gone through the experience, share with our listeners how you've kind of felt like this process went.
Well, I mean, from my experience, everything that happened, it basically says to me that if you can find the right doctor and the right clinic, you can get a medical marijuana card for any reason, qualifying condition or no. And the state essentially has no way to check whether or not you actually have one. The only way in which you would face repercussions is if you found your day in a courtroom and were facing prosecution for possession of marijuana, regardless of whether or not you're on the registry.
Now, that is kind of scary. So even if you have a medical marijuana card and you have marijuana on your person, just personal use, you could get brought up on charges, possession of marijuana. You can say, well, I got the card. But then the authorities could come back and challenge the card and then question how you got it.
Yes, essentially, the card shows that you're on the registry, but it does not mean that you're exempt from prosecution. You are immune, you know, if you're within the limits of the range, more than likely an officer's never going to handcuff you because they just look at the card. They don't know who your certifying physician is. They know that you're on the registry and that's it. So if you're within the limits, there's a very small likelihood that you'll ever be prosecuted. However, if you exceed them and they decide to bring charges against you, that is when a judge could decide, we want to see whether you have a bona fide physician-patient relationship. And then that's when you're relying on a doctor to say, yes, we have medical records. We've either looked at their primary physicians once or we've made a diagnosis of a qualifying condition, and that continues. And you're entirely reliant, your legal immunity will be largely reliant on whether or not you have a physician that's willing to go to bat for you.
And in your case, you went through a physician who you saw for a total of how many minutes?
30 seconds. He asked approximately 4 questions before certifying me.
Really? Mm-hmm. Like what? What's your name?
He asked me, have you ever had a medical marijuana card before? Why are you here today? And then when I told him my medical condition, they said, do you know what's causing it? And then I told him what my neurologist had told me. And then he said, okay, well, you're all set. Go up and pick up your paperwork from the front desk.
Did you bring some records in to show everything?
I did not.
So you didn't bring any medical records or anything with you to prove your medical condition?
No, I mean, but that was also in part the point of the story. If I brought medical records, there would have been $50 off, but instead I just...
You would have gotten a discount.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't save money in the deal, is what you're saying, but it wouldn't prove the point. How fascinating, and in a way kind of sad that after all these years of having the medical marijuana law on the books, this is still a process that folks go through on a regular basis to get their medical marijuana card.
Yeah, and I think one of the looming issues for this is that for Michiganders who want to get a card for very valid reasons, if they have a qualifying medical condition, there is almost no information available for them to keep themselves protected under the law. They don't have the information readily available from state government or other sources to know that the way that they are getting certified for a medical marijuana card will stand up under scrutiny of law.
For our listeners' benefit, how did you stumble upon the doctor?
Well, there was a
Proctor, right? Dr.
Yes,
Proctor. How did you stumble upon the doctor?
Well, there's a number of Facebook groups online, and they basically advertise a doctor. And they say, bring this much money, bring medical records. But I'd heard from another person who got certified through this physician that they did not bring any medical records. They just spoke about joint pain in their hands, and then they were certified. And I was told about the location, which is the back of an appliance wholesaler in North Lansing.
This wasn't exactly a medical facility that you would go for anything else.
No, it was not. It was an empty room with a plywood countertop and a circle of chairs in the corner.
God, this kind of sounds like an old movie from like the 1950s or something like that. It's a little...
Well, it wasn't on a school ground out next to the fence or something. So there's been progress.
Well, Simon, I got to say you did a fantastic job on the story. Great work on getting it up there, and I hope our readers have a chance to... look at it. If you don't subscribe to MERS, you can read it by going to MERS Facebook page. John has posted it on our Facebook page, so if you have some time to go ahead and read it, I highly recommend it.
I was gonna go to work, but then I got high. Ooh, I just got a new promotion, but I got high.
I'm joined with Saul Anousis, former Michigan Republican Party chair. We all know Saul Anousis. Saul, the Popular Vote Compact is something that you've been involved in for several years. Why do you think that this is a system that Republicans should embrace?
Well, first of all, I think it's good for the country. I think, you know, 4 out of 5 Americans live in either a decidedly Republican or a decidedly Democratic state, which means by effect they're ignored in presidential general elections. And so what happens is we elect the president of the battleground states of America versus the president of the United States of America. So from a policy perspective, I think that it would make more sense for us to use the national popular vote in determining how we select our electors at the state-based level, which is why we're supporting the National Popular Vote Compact, which is really kind of the state-based solution to this and has bipartisan support as well as bipartisan opposition. The National Popular Vote Constitutional Amendment that a lot of the Democrats are pushing would basically federalize the elections, and I would oppose that. And I think that'd be bad for the country, and I think it'd be bad for Republicans. And so, you know, the reason this is good for Republicans only is because it's fair. I think the current system probably benefits Democrats today. I think there is a blue wall that is beneficial to Democrats. I think illegal immigration benefits the Democrats on this move, where if you had a national popular vote that let every American in every state vote and every time and matter and the same, you know, basically have a similar vote, that I think it would be a fair system that would be good for Republicans.
Folks in Michigan could say this isn't going to be good for Michigan, because we're technically a battleground state. We had Donald Trump and we had Hillary Clinton in our state numerous times. We had TV ad revenue up the wazoo. Why would we want to give that up?
Well, first of all, this was a unique situation. I mean, since 1988, literally in the last, you know, 6 presidential elections, we haven't been a red state or a battleground state. I mean, we've basically voted Democrat, and most people consider us a purple state that could go red under the right circumstances. We lean Democrat when it comes to presidential campaigns. And it's a fleeting status. I mean, you know, I think Donald Trump was a unique candidate that appealed to the voters of Michigan, appealed to our kind of Reagan Democrat constituency, and played well there. But that doesn't always happen, and I don't think that's going to happen necessarily in the future. So if you move to a national popular vote compact where the states would use and allocate their delegates based on a national popular vote, what that would do is make sure that every vote in Michigan would matter every time. So we would be campaigning and making sure that the margins are being done in outstate Michigan. We would compete for the Reagan Democrat blue-collar vote in downstate Michigan and Macomb County, downriver, etc. So I think it would just be a different dynamic that would make sure that we're always relevant in the process.
You take a look at the last presidential elections, this last one with Donald Trump and the free trade, before that Mitt Romney and the auto bailout. These are issues that directly impacted Michigan, though. Would there be a concern under this kind of national vote or this popular vote compact that our issues wouldn't become front burner issues?
No, because I think those issues affected the country as a whole. I mean, there are some unique issues that were targeted to just battleground states. So, you know, whether it was Ohio as a feeder state to the auto industry in Michigan or some other things, maybe they were brought up in a different way than they would have under normal circumstances. But you still have to take a look at when the auto industry is a major job provider in the country. Trump has made a commitment, you know, to bringing jobs back to Michigan. Others have. I think you're going to have a different perspective. And so I think that, you know, when you're running a national campaign and worrying about issues that affect the country, jobs is going to be a big part of it. And jobs clearly are affected in Michigan and the Midwest.
How much of this is Michigan kind of getting over the fact that, hey, listen, it's not all about us. It's not all about the battleground states of America. It's all about the United States and making sure everyone's got an equal opportunity to be exposed to the candidates who are running for president.
Yeah, look, I think that's a factor. I think it is important for us to make sure. We elect 514,000 elected officials in this country, and all of them but one is elected by whoever gets the most votes in their respective districts. If you had a national popular vote for president, you would basically be running nationwide rather than only in the battleground states. And that would produce a different candidate and a different campaign, which I think would be good for this country. So my argument is that if it's good for the country, it's good for Michigan. And I think that if we were to make sure that every Michigan voter would be as relevant as an Ohio voter, as an example, that would be good for us. I think it's crazy that Ohio and Florida have a disproportionate amount of interest than most of the other states do. And so therefore, it'd be good to have a better process that would make sure that every vote in every state in every election actually mattered.
So you're an advisor to this popular vote compact. Why this approach as opposed to something like Senator Boxer put out there where we just go straight to an elimination of the Electoral College?
Well, first of all, I would oppose eliminating the Electoral College because I think the Electoral College is critical to make sure that states have a voice in the process. It's one of the three provisions in the Constitution that were exclusively given to state legislatures to make sure that they had an influence in the federal government. The Electoral College is the process by which we can guarantee states' voices in electing a president. If you nationalize that election, if you basically eliminate the Electoral College, then the federal government would run it. And I think that it's bad for the system. It's anti-federalist. It would concentrate too much power in a central place. By keeping the Electoral College in play, every state still has a voice, but they're using the national popular vote to determine how they use that voice. And if there are unintended consequences or something else changes down the line and we want to run a different system, it still is the power of the states to determine how they allocate their delegates to the Electoral College.
Because they could jump in and out of the compact based on a vote of their state legislature.
Absolutely. And so if they're, you know, if let's say we went in it and we found out that 4 years down the line or 8 years down the line, it doesn't have the results we thought, it didn't fix the problems that we were concerned about, it didn't make the rest of the country relevant, we can always pull out. And as soon as it drops under the 270 electoral vote threshold that is necessary to win the presidency, and that's how many states have to be in this compact before it takes effect, it reverts back to the old system. And today, look, 48 states use a winner-take-all system, as Michigan does. Two states, Nebraska and Maine, use a congressional district plan, which basically allocates their delegates based on congressional districts. So there are options, and a state like Massachusetts has actually used 12 different ways of doing it over the 250-year history of this country, where most states east of the Mississippi have used, on average, twice. They've changed, and everyone west of the Mississippi, because they got their statehood later, accepted the winner-take-all system. So, again, it's a power that's designed, that's given to the state legislators on purpose to use it in their selfish best interest. I would argue it is in Michigan's selfish best interest to make sure that our voters matter in every election and that our voters are as relevant as Ohio and Florida's voters. And this is the only system that is practical, real, and is actually moving across the country that could actually implement that change.
Saul Anousis, appreciate your time today.
Great to be with you.
We the people. Establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty.
Joining us now on the podcast is Ed Zarpolis, the president of Target Insight. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you on this warm, sunny, snowy morning in
March. Yeah, right. Warm, yeah, maybe warm compared to the North Pole. Well, Ed, it's never too early to talk about what the 2021 map drawing process could look like. You have gone through the process of developing what the next congressional map could look like. But before we get into it, just remind our listeners your background and your interest in drawing congressional, state legislative, and political maps in general.
I started a redistricting process, learning about it, drawing lines, consulting nationally as a part of a national team, developing software back in the mid-80s. In the 1990s, part of the legislative process, I was part of the team that was actually went to court, was deposed, all that kind of stuff. So since about 1985 until today, I've been involved in redistricting either here in Michigan or in other states. And in 2011, I was invited to assist in drawing the city council boundaries as city of Chicago.
And you have all this new fancy-dancy software, so it's not like you're doing all these districts by hand. You've got some computer programs, and based on your experience, are putting together maps that are extremely plausible for a Republican majority in 2021.
Why are we doing this? First of all, back in the 80s, some of us used to use bingo chips to cover over geography to decide where we're going to place whatever. And but essentially, why are we doing this now? 2018 will be the last time the Democrats have a chance of controlling all three pieces of drawing the lines: the governor's office, state senate, and state house. If they only win one of those chambers, they can negotiate. But Republicans right now, in 2010, had all three chambers. They control the process. So 2018 is very significant. Secondly, there's a lot of talk about the Democrats will never be able to take back Congress unless they control the pens. And even ex-president, former President Obama right now said he's going to be part of a national campaign and be sure the lines are drawn properly, not so gerrymandering as it's called. And even our current Congressman Schauer, late Congressman, former Congressman Schauer, has been involved in that process too, as going nationally wise to do that. So we took a look at is that, okay, what does this mean? We have a potential ballot proposal next year. Progressives in Michigan and some other people concerned about the partisan thing to have developed a ballot proposal to have created a nonpartisan commission. Technically, they don't work, but they're going to try to do something like Florida and some other states did. So what we did is, in fact, we took today's geography and began to draw the lines. And also we know from the Census Bureau that, in fact, Michigan most likely will lose a congressional district. So right now we have 14 districts, 9 Republican and 5 Democrat. If we lose one, we're going to be down to 13 districts. What's key here, what's very interesting, how could Trump help Michigan? There's been some studies done across the country that showing that if Donald Trump were successful eliminating all illegal immigrants across the nation, we'd probably save our one congressional district.
Is that right?
Yes. Because remember, population assignment is based on population in the state, not residents, not American residents or citizenship, based on population in the country at the time of the census.
Oh, I thought it was based on registered voters.
No.
Oh.
No. Some people have fought for registered voters, but the census population taken got who is residing in the United States at the time of the census, generally the April of that year.
But we're all kind of presuming that we are going to lose one seat. And the question is if Republicans are able to keep control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, what could a congressional map look like, and could they preserve all 9 of their seats?
Matter of fact, I did took 2 or 3 days to actually do that. We found that Republicans can't maintain their 9 congressional Republican districts.
And Democrats could be bumped down to 4?
Down to 4, yes. The most likely the district that would be eliminated would be Congressman Sandy Levin's district in Macomb County and Oakland County. Sandy Levin's district would be absorbed into Brenda Lawrence's district. And one of the interesting things in drawing these lines is the fact the question is that there's been some debate of what are you going to do about who else is going to be paired together. Well, when drawing these lines, the fact is that there was an assumption that Congressman Trott and Congressman Bishop would be paired together in the same district because of the connection between Brenda Lawrence's districts, between her district and Pontiac. When drawing these lines of the fact, you can create 2 majority minority black districts without having to attach the Pontiac to the city, the Congressman Brenda Lawrence's district.
And for our listeners' benefit, in order to try and avoid a federal suit, the Republicans would want to keep 2 districts, based in the city of Detroit to keep those districts that have a majority of their population being minority voters. So to avoid a federal civil rights case, they have to preserve those two. So once again, even though the city of Detroit should be its own congressional district, but to avoid a federal lawsuit, you have to split it in half, and that's what you did here.
Well, yes, we did. But secondly, the Republicans want to maintain the voting rights districts for one other reason. Because as you concentrate Democrats in one or two districts, it doesn't allow the Democrats to share those Democrats with other congressional districts to basically go from only four Democratic districts to maybe five Democratic districts.
As we're taking a look here at this map, what are some of the key changes that we could expect from a Republican-drawn congressional map in 2021?
Well, let's start up the Upper Peninsula. Okay, the first congressional sort of draws itself. We just added Maseaukee, West Grumman, and Ogama counties, and Osco, and basically that was only 227 people over the exact population that you need, because remember the population is going to increase per district up to about 60,000 versus the 705,000 that we currently have in our district. Number two, Congressman Molinar's district is going to absorb Bay County. That's a very Democratic county, but still puts him over 50%. Now, why is Bay County so critical? And the other county is going to be Ingham County. What we found in drawing these lines is the fact that what you do with Bay County and what you do with Ingham County determines whether or not the 4th Congressional, the 3rd Congressional, or the 7th Congressional either leans Democratic or basically makes it very competitive. By giving Molinar the Bay County and giving Congressman Amash Ingham County, that allows the Republicans to maintain their 9 Republican districts.
Whoa. So in order to do this, you basically split Kent County up a little bit here too, and
yes,
gave Huizenga a bigger chunk of Grand Rapids, gave him Byron Township, gave him Wyoming, Granville, Walker, and then Amash gets moved over all the way to Clinton and Ingham County. So in Lansing, under this plan, Justin Amash would be the congressman for Ingham County.
But basically, Michigan's favorite congressman will now represent both the West Michigan and Central Michigan, and now it's both capitals. He'll be working on both capitals, capital in Washington, D.C., and the capital of Lansing.
Wow, now that would be really interesting to see what kind of appeal. Now, this would make, it would seem then, the 3rd congressional district a lot more competitive.
It will be making competitive. As a matter of fact, the numbers for that district actually improve a little bit. The 3rd congressional district improves slightly Democratic. The Democratic base in the old district was 44%. The new one is 47%, so it will be much more competitive. So be like, you know, so they'll be very key for a 53-47 versus, you know, 50-56, that type of thing. And the reason why I did that, in fact, is because remember the old district plan brought it down into Berry County, and because of the growth of population, if you don't do that, then you're making that district much more Democratic.
And now I'm taking a look here at your Democratic numbers now. While you're preserving the 9 Republican seats, many of these districts have gotten a lot more competitive. And I just mentioned Justin Amash, but we're taking a look at David Trott's district, Paul Mitchell's district in the 10th.
Yes.
All of these get a lot more competitive, and it puts more of these in play for Democrats, possibly.
Well, it does, but Republicans would have to decide, do they want safe Republican seats, which means then they're going to give Democrats maybe one or two potential seats, going from the 4 back up to 6, and they'll be down to, you know, about 7 or 8. So the Republicans are basically have to hope ongoing good years. But the bottom line is if you're going to add 50,000-60,000 people per district, then you're going to have to move the Mitchell's district all the way down almost to the 8-mile border, which is highly Democratic. What's very interesting is there was some talk about Congressman Kildee's district being one the Republicans might eliminate. Well, they don't. In order to solve their problem, the fact now Kildee actually represents most of the thumb. You know, to here, like here, Huron Township, Tuscola, Sanilac, the Pierre and Genesee County.
Now, what would happen if you got rid of Kildee's county or district as opposed to Sandy Levin's? Is it just too difficult with all the line breaks to make it happen?
No, actually, matter of fact, then you're going to have Genesee County, which is predominantly all Democratic. So then you're going to definitely give Republicans potential losses.
Okay.
And that's the same thing happened why you want Ingham County had to be careful for what you do in Ingham County, because with Lansing area being highly Democratic. I played with all these different counties. As you start playing around these counties, you got to decide where are the Democrat votes packed. And so like I could safely take away Bay County, which is relatively Democratic, and give it to Molinar. But the point being the fact if you eliminate Genesee County and Kent Kildee, then you've got Paul Mitchell taking up Genesee County or Muller taking Genesee County. So
you don't want that.
No, you have to basically move Kildee into the thumb area. move Mitchell's district down further. It almost counted north of the city of Warren and Roseville and that type of area.
And we're going to post this map on our website so folks can take a look at it here and see it for themselves. We've only got a couple minutes here left, Ed, but I think a real takeaway here is that Democrats have to be concerned that if they don't win something in 2018, this is what they're looking at here.
Oh, definitely. I've played with these maps for a long time now, and this is being conservative here. Now, obviously, with census numbers, things will change. But the bottom line is, other than maybe there's fewer African-Americans in Wayne County, that maybe you have to go back up the Pontiac. But the bottom line is Republicans can draw 9 Republican districts, and Democrats probably one we have to absorb the one loss.
How much difference would it make if the Democrats just won the governorship? Any difference at all?
Oh, yes. They could negotiate making these seats much more competitive. They could probably at least probably maybe move up to five districts potentially, and maybe even a split sixth district. Because I could change these. For example, if I move Ingham County into the 7th district or the Molinar district, then I'm looking at much more, potentially one or two more seats for Democrats to take a look at.
If they also took the House, it'd be even more of an opportunity for the Democrats, right?
That'll be questioned who draws the line in the sand. Bottom line, if you control one chamber, it's just as good as controlling all three.
Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight. Appreciate you putting all these maps together. And again, we're going to have these on our website so folks can take a look at it and see what a best case scenario, worst case scenario is, depending on what side
depending
of the aisle
you are.
Ed, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Saul Anousis. Thanks for Ed Zarpolis for dropping these off. And Simon, you didn't bring any brownies for us. Now that you have like the medical marijuana card, that the least you could have done was bake some brownies for us, dude.
Well, Kyle, I'm going to follow the law. You know, that would be against. That would be illegal.
I don't think he could still bake brownies, couldn't he? I mean, I think that's only the fair thing to do now.
Oh, I'm all for the brownie stuff. I think is there a right for them to have a? Do you have to put a list of ingredients on your brownies? I don't think you do.
No, I don't think that there is either. I mean, you just say that they're brownies. You wouldn't have to do.
Well, that's the thing is, edible products were actually illegal under Michigan law until recently. I think with the passage of the Michigan Medical the Facilities Act, legalized them.
I wonder if we'd have a better newsletter if we brought in brownies, dude.
I think it'd be probably getting out a lot later.
If you didn't like MERS coming out at 10 o'clock, then you wouldn't like it coming out at midnight either.
Being able to bring pies to fairs and things like that, I think that law has run into some problems, the one against making pies and so on and so forth.
What does that got to do about brownies, dude?
Well, he was saying it's illegal to make food in the public places and so on and so forth, but I think there are exceptions to that, county fairs, etc.
Yeah, Jack's got your back, dude.
I think this whole conversation is going up in smoke, Kyle.
You got to be proud with the puns here, aren't you?
Hey, man, who cares?
It's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.